Accession number 18802, Reel 8.
Brigadier Cowan, Reel 8. I think you were saying that you didn't know the tactical details of these exercises conducted jointly by your regiment and the tanks and the artillery.
No. I mean, rightly or wrongly, I conceived it my duty to concentrate solely on the signal side. I mean, I wasn't interested in what anybody else was doing. All I was concerned with was making sure we, A, obtained, and secondly, retained our reputation as the best signals lot in Germany.
How did your signals compare with theirs, then, the armoured regiments and the gunners?
Well, within their own regiments and their own squadrons, I haven't the faintest notion. As far as the rear link was concerned, we competed with each other, and eventually people realised there was a competition going on, and I think it generally raised the whole standard of the rear links to brigade. And indeed, sometimes brigade headquarters was found wanting, and we were all doing rather better.
So you didn't communicate with these people directly. You were communicating back via brigade.
If there was a battalion squadron exercise going on, well, naturally the squadron would be on the battalion net.
Yes.
If there was a company troop exercise going on, the troop would be on the company net. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking more generally about the armoured regimental headquarters and the motor battalion headquarters both being on the brigade rear, the brigade net.
When you went on these training exercises out on battalion scale or company scale, were you exercising over training areas or were you just using the countryside?
It's difficult to recall the difference between what was going on then in 1949-52 and what was going on later when I fetched up in 12th Brigade when the nuclear battle had arrived. And it's quite difficult to separate in one's mind in detail exactly where you went on those two separate occasions. Mainly it was training area. I mean, the Soltau training area, the Sennelager training area were the two main ones. And, of course, the trouble was people got to know them rather well. And, you know, somebody would say, oh, you remember that tree over there? Well, go and do something near that or whatever. But occasionally one did a major move from one training area to another. And that obviously interrupted civilian traffic and so on. But it was largely the main activities, as opposed to a move, the main training took place in the training areas.
Were you able to do a lot of live firing?
Again, I have to take refuge in my signalling job, because I honestly don't know what they got up to a lot of the time. If you're thinking in terms of live firing, as you might find it, say, at Otterburn and things like that, the answer is no, because the training areas I've just been talking about didn't lend themselves to that sort of thing. But there were, of course, firing ranges, both the tanks, the artillery, and for the infantry. But that was a slightly separate issue.
One of the frequent comments one hears about the army at this stage is that it was rather difficult to train specialists in the time available because of the period of national service. Did you find that a difficulty?
I think it was a challenge rather than a difficulty. And of course, because it was national service, you tended to get some quite bright people, despite the fact the infantry wasn't reckoned to get bright people. I think the motor infantry had a certain reputation. And there were always enough bright people coming along to fill the specialist jobs. It did mean, of course, by the time you'd trained them and taught them and got one training season out of them, it was time for them to move on, one and a half training seasons perhaps. And so, yes, it was a nuisance. But as I say, I think it was a challenge. And of course, in terms of the the outside world in terms of the reserve forces and so on, we were turning out a lot of very highly skilled people.
That's true, but is it not the case that signalling is one of those skills that has to be practiced to keep it up to scratch? Is it like riding a bicycle, something you never forget, or is it something you have to keep on practicing to maintain your edge?
I think if you were to give me, I mean, last time I touched a 19 set, I hate to think how many years ago it was, but if you now gave me a vehicle, a 19 set, a 34-foot mast aerial and a whip aerial and some other sort of aerial, and a battery that was working, I think I would still make a 19 set work.
So it's like riding a bicycle?
I think it's a bit like riding a bicycle. Now, having said that, if you were talking about the various dials that you'd played about with. Now, I remember one was the tuning dial. Now,
yes.
What the hell the other dial was called, I've absolutely forgotten. But on the 19 set, there was a dial there and there was a dial there, and you tuned them both, and as you say, you locked on. I can't remember what the other one was called, but I'd know what to do with it if I saw it.
Hmm. Well, what about the voice procedure?
That would come back. But, of course, it's all changed.
Yes.
Some of the technical phrases have all changed. Mm. But I could, if I put my mind to it, I could write down now, I suppose, 30 or so of the main phrases that I was taught and taught myself and taught our people. And after a day, I reckon I could be as fast as I was then. Mm. No, that's not quite true, because my brain doesn't work quite as fast as it worked then, and probably my tongue doesn't either, but I'd be pretty skillful.
And one of the things you mentioned was the question of a nuclear battlefield. As I recall it, the Russians exploded their first atomic device in 1949. Do you remember that happening and whether it had any implications for you at the time?
I haven't the faintest notion.
Mm. Now, you also moved, didn't you, from Celle to Minden during this?
From Minden to Celle.
Oh, from Minden to Celle,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Was there any significant difference between the two locations?
Yes. Celle is a nicer place, and it so happened we went into an enormous barracks, I mean a really a huge barracks, which had been, I think, German panzer barracks, German chemical corps barracks. I mean, it was a huge place. We could only sort of manage about half of it, and eventually a divisional headquarters fetched up there. Sometime after. And so these great open spaces and really quite nice barrack rooms and offices and so on, we were really rather pleased to get into. Yeah. And it was that much nearer the training area.
What were your relations with the local population like?
There must have been... I should think probably the commanding officer and one or two others who got involved in the local side. Most of us didn't, and of course it's this awful business of cantonments that one tends to mix with one's own and shops with one's own and so on, the naffy shop and all the rest of it. I mean, people did go to the German market. Jennifer could probably answer this question better than I can. I was so busy minding my own business, trying to get my radios working properly, that I hardly met any Germans, other than perhaps sometimes on the training area, when on the whole they were very friendly, despite the fact we were ploughing up their land.
Where were you living?
We had an army quarter, and it was close to the barracks, and we were very comfortable there.
Was this a former German married quarter, or had it been built by us, or requisitioned?
It hadn't been built by us, no. It was in a street called Bremerweg, I remember. But, I think it was just a civilian house that had been taken over by the army. It certainly wasn't built as military quarters, that's for sure.
Your next move, I think, was from Signals to 2IC of a company.
Yes.
At 1952.
Yes. That was, I think, partly I think they reckoned, I'd done 2 years as Signals officer by then, and I think they probably thought that was long enough, because it was quite a tough job. And also, because I, you know, was competing to go to the Staff College and so on, I think yes. they probably thought some bit of, sort of bringing me back to Earth again wouldn't be a bad idea, which I think was probably true.
What were your main functions as 2IC, a rifle company?
Well, to be a motor company, actually, it was
motor company.
In those days. High company. To be the deputy to the company commander, if he was away for any reason. In particular, to be responsible for the administration of the company. And I suppose because of my signals background, inevitably to duff up the signals in the company. But also to keep an eye, we had our own MT sergeant who looked after the half tracks, and so I was responsible for sort of keeping an eye on him. Administration is the the main thing.
What did the administration consist of? And was it mainly paperwork? Or were you out and about visiting and inspecting? And
there was a certain amount of paperwork, certain amount of account work, you know, the company account and that sort of thing. The payrolls one was responsible for. But I think it was a mix between being in the office and getting round the barracks and just keeping an eye on the bit we were responsible for.
How many soldiers did you have in the company?
I should think probably about 120.
So you're up to strength?
No, because I think we should have had about 150.
I
may have got the figures slightly wrong, but it was something of that order.
Do you remember doing any significant exercises or training while you were 2IC?
No, I just remember sort of long flogs from going from A to B and sort of running around when we got to B. And then going home again. My main recollection of that is I'd taken the Staff College exam and had been posted to Australia, which I'd love to go to, but it so happened for various family reasons I didn't particularly want to go to Australia at that moment, and so I lodged an application to go to Camberley. And the divisional commander, who was Splosh Jones, who a name you probably have come across over the years, father of the present Quartermaster General, or perhaps he's just finished being the Quartermaster General, Edward Jones. But he had been involved in my selection for the Staff College, and also the change to Camberley from Australia. And I can remember I was out on the roadside with my company doing some exercise or other, and there was the divisional commander steaming along in his Jeep Land Rover at about 50, coming to a screeching halt and turning around and saying, "Alan, you're all right for Camberley," or words to that effect. And, you know, one remembers that sort of thing as being a very friendly gesture and not necessarily what a divisional commander would normally be doing.
I mean, did you see a lot of the divisional commander in the normal course of things?
No, not a lot. But I think he probably saw enough to know that we were either all right or not all right.
What about brigade commander? Did he come round regularly?
No, one saw him from time to time, but not a lot, no.
You mentioned doing exercises at battalion level with squadrons. Did you do brigade and divisional exercises at all?
Yes. There tended to be two sorts, either the signals sort, which was just skeleton headquarters going out, or the full-scale FTX, which was, you know, the battalion, the brigade, the division, or whatever it was. They didn't happen very often, and always in the late summer, early autumn.
Autumn manoeuvres.
Autumn manoeuvres, yes. Or summer manoeuvres. Usually it was so you started at the lower levels and worked up, and it was a continuous period.
Just
sort of in and out of barracks and progression. And of course, one of the sad things about that was one didn't see one's children growing up. Summer, I think I went once to a summer holiday with my children in the whole of their growing up period, which is sad but inevitable.
When you went on, you know, large-scale exercise, divisional level or so, how many days would that last?
I can't remember half these things. Certainly not less than 3 days, and probably a week or so.
So you go out into the field for that?
Yes. Yes. And regardless of what the weather was doing.
And what sort of form did they take normally? Were you aware of what the divisional scheme was, what the plan was at divisional and core level, whether it was real or notional?
Yes, one was aware of it, but one was more specifically concerned with one's own individual part in it. But I don't think there's anything one can usefully say about it except, you know, it was practicing the machinery.
Yeah.
Well, that's really what it was up to.
Would you recall if there was more advancing to contact or more withdrawing and blocking or anything of that sort?
I think that came later, my second time in Germany, in 12 Brigade, when we were doing this sort of river watching and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think this was much more... my recollection is, and I may be quite wrong, my recollection is it was much more fluid and sort of rather just a progression from the Second War rather than sort of the new techniques that went with the nuclear battle.
Did you see anything of Allied forces while you were 2IC or signals officer?
No, I was aware of them, in particular the Belgians. But if you ask me what they were up to, I haven't the faintest idea.
Have you ever seen anything of the Americans?
Again, I think one's awareness of people being around, I think probably it would be the Belgians first, the Americans second, and the French third. Now, why I say that, I can't really remember, but it's my recollection of our state of awareness of them.
In 1952, it was first proposed that the Germans should be allowed to rearm and take some of the burden of defending their own territory. Do you remember that proposal being made?
That was 52, was it?
Yes.
I remember Adenauer inspecting, and I was back in England by then, I'm sure, I feel sure I was, but I remember the first time that I had seen a German unit being drawn up for inspection with a large military band playing Deutschland über alles, and Adenauer doing the inspection, and I remember a cold shiver going down my back saying it's all going to happen again. Now that's, I mean, that was an instinctive reaction of somebody of my generation when that happened, and that I suppose must have been in 53 probably.
I think they weren't actually up and running till about 55.
Oh, well, it's whenever it was.
Yes, I mean, the proposal was made in 52, and it was blocked and delayed.
I'm not sure I was even aware the proposal was made then. I just don't know. No idea.
You mentioned the Star College exam. Do you remember what was in the exam, what you had to do, and how you prepared for it?
I prepared for it night after night after night, reading God knows what in the way of military law, a little bit of military history, not enough, and really just basic amount to get by. Various tactical things one was supposed to read. I mean, there was a syllabus, and I flogged through it. And
was this all done on your own? Did you have any training periods for instruction?
Yes, there was a pre-staff college course at Senilago, which I went to, which, if I remember, was 2 weeks or something like that. Very concentrated.
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of first cousin to Mott's for GC and that sort of thing. But I do remember it was frightfully hard work. And I think the result of it all was that instead of reading for pleasure and reading to sort of stimulate my intellect, I think I really remember reading to get facts and things into my nut sufficiently to pass the exam, which I don't think really was an ideal way of doing it.
So you're cramming yourself?
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, was there an education officer at brigade level or divisional level who you could use as a field tutor or for bibliographical or other advice?
I don't remember it. I do remember doing a correspondence course.
Yes.
Metropolitan College. Yeah. Correspondence course, which I found very good, very helpful. But again, it was jolly hard work on top of one's normal day.
Well, this would consist of writing essays, sending them in and getting them back marked.
Yes, exactly that. And I found them very good. And I think a lot of people use them.
So you prepared for the exam. You took the exam actually in the battalion, or did you have to go to a divisional centre?
No, we went to a central place, which I suspect was Senilago.
Yes.
I honestly can't remember. Mm. I think it was Senilago. And a lot of white-faced people fetching up to take this exam. Mm.
How long was it before you got the results?
Oh dear. I don't know. Can't remember. It wasn't all that long.
Anyway, you passed the exam, obviously, and you went off in 1953 to the Staff College.
Do you remember? Which, of course, was a wonderful year to be there, coronation year.
Yes. Do you remember what was on the syllabus and how you studied it?
Well, it, as you know, it's largely a syndicate set up, or it was then, and I imagine probably still is. And so one fetched up in a room, 10 of us, with one DS, and he took us through the syllabus, really. Mm-hmm. And I remember the opening term being absolutely stressing the importance of staff duties and the basics or tactical things and learning how to run a meeting and take minutes of a meeting, that sort of thing. The first elementary bits of military writing, I think it was called. Some general interest lectures given to the college as a whole. And then we did the odd divisional lighting, a division being the staff college split into three. A division was roughly from about 60 from memory. Well, yeah, six syndicates of 10. And we sort of ambled off to study ground and make tactical plans, and et cetera, et cetera.
What sort of level were you making plans?
Initially, I should think initially probably company and battalion, and then it progressed to brigade and division. And when you got to telephone battles, they tended to be divisional level.
Yeah. What sort of level would you work out when you were going off on a tute, on an appreciation and a tute?
I find it difficult to recall in detail. I would guess regimental.
And if you were having a telephone battle, how long would that last?
48 to 72 hours. Something of that sort.
Do you think that they were conducted in a realistic way?
They were fun. And of course, they were if you were given one of the key jobs, they were even more fun. I was lucky I was made the divisional commander on one of them. And I remember spending hours just sort of, you know, bellowing down a radio set saying, you know, let's do so and so, let's do something else. It was quite fun, but again, they tried to be realistic in that they put pressure on people, and one tended not to get very much sleep. And that was probably good training.
So one form of pressure would be insomnia, artificially induced insomnia. What other means did they use to put people under pressure?
Oh, I suppose I find that quite a difficult question to answer. I mean, I suppose one was being inspected, if that's the right word, the whole time, to see how one was reacting to circumstances, new problems, etc. But how they were set and how one was sort of responding to them, I don't remember, except I do remember there were problems, changing circumstances, changing scenes, and one did one's best. But one flexibility, I suppose, comes into that.
Yes, I mean, one obvious way is to increase the flow of information and the demand for decisions. A sort of information overload.
Yes, I don't recall any of that being excessive. I do recall there being enough information and enough for one to be able to make sensible plans and decisions. But I don't remember being overwhelmed by the information.
When you had these telephone battles, were you opposed? Was there another team of commanders playing against you, or were the enemy played by the directing staff?
What a difficult question.
Or did you not know?
I'm sure I did know, and I'm sure I ought to remember. I suspect that initially they were probably DS, but I seem to remember there was one at the end that were two different sides, I think, but I honestly don't remember.
Hmm. Where were the telephone battles set? Were they set in England or Germany or elsewhere?
I think they were an imaginary land called Fantasia or something like that, probably.
But you must have had maps of terrain and so on to plan on. And
European, I would say.
Yes. Yeah. You mentioned that you were in a syndicate. Did you remain in the same syndicate all the way through the course?
No. You didn't? No, you did a different syndicate each term.
Right.
But just to give an example, my first term, there was an Indian called Baggy Luthera, who was a good deal older than me, I think 10, 12, 15 years older than me, who had been a major in the old Indian Army, got an MC during the war. And it just so happened that January, when the term started, it was very cold and there was snow, and so Jennifer and I took a certain amount of interest in the foreigners in our syndicate. And sort of, I remember going to see Baggy in his quarter, which was on the edge of Camberley, and they had a little boy called Tommy, I remember, who was aged about four, who was a very naughty little boy indeed, and Tommy this and Tommy that. And they were miserable, they were cold, etc., etc., and you know, strange country. And so we looked after them a bit, and they've never forgotten it. And we have corresponded on a Christmas card basis every year since. I've never been to India. He did come to England once, and there was some reason. We were going to France or something on a planned trip, a program, and there was some reason we couldn't see him. But he came last year and came here. We met him at Kingham Station, and you know, Cotswolders goggle-eyed to see this good lady in her sari getting off the train. And they came here. We had a very happy lunch party and drove him around the countryside a little bit. And he then went away again. He was over connected with the. I think he was one of the Indian representatives for the VE Day celebrations.
Roughly what proportion of the student body were overseas?
In a division of 60, I would guess there were probably 12. I mean, that's a very general statement. I would guess there were 12.
And what sort of places were they from?
Well, we had... in.